This week on Your Western Context, auditors recommend a sharp reduction in city supervisors to save money. Shootings are up despite Trudeau's gun ban, and Guilbeault wants tech companies to give money to the media. Also, O'Toole unites while Trudeau divides. This is Western Context, episode 186, recorded Friday, September 11th, 2020. The Politics of Division. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here, as we are each and every week, and we're well into September right now, and the news just keeps building up, and you know the echoes are starting to appear in the air and in the water, so to speak, of what we might be seeing in the upcoming federal government throne speech. But that's all but one story. We're here to talk about the news as we do each and every week.
Yes, as we move closer and closer to fall, as the weather starts to change and the nights start to get a little bit longer, the days get a bit shorter, we see more and more news piling up towards what many are speculating may be a fall election, triggered by who we don't know, but we do see a lot of news in the media out there that has kind of flown under the radar and hasn't received the proper attention that it deserves.
That's right. And if you're joining us for the first time, that's what Western Context is all about. We're a podcast that aims to cut through all that media bias and sensationalism that you find in the news, that you read online, in print, on the TV, practically anywhere with that, and in doing so and removing all that bias and sensationalism, hopefully we'll provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we are going to begin this week with our Alberta story, which is one that comes out of the city of Edmonton, the city council, something that was very shocking to the mayor and very sobering at the same time with this. And this is that the city auditors recommended that the city of Edmonton reduce its number of supervisors and managers following a 21% increase over the last 3 years. And going back to the UCP's election in 2019, one of their main talking points in their election platform was to get provincial spending under control. And despite what some city politicians might think, cities do indeed fall under the jurisdiction of the provincial government when it comes to where they get their funding from for most of the things. Now, we have heard many times, of course, that reducing spending would harm services or put people out of work, and that the cities just do not want to go that path. They're all, of course, very focused on building their vanity projects of bike lanes and new types of architecture that could have instead been put into rehabilitating our roads and sewer and water infrastructure. Now, the cities, of course, also always say they want to find another way and are often just content to raise your property taxes and increase user fees for city services while adding more and more spending. Because recall, unlike our provincial and federal governments, cities cannot run deficits. Now, the city of Edmonton got quite a surprise this week when the Office of the City Auditor recommended that the city look at a growing number of supervisors and middle managers if spending is to be reduced. Many city services, including transit, are on the edge of being financially sustainable after the pandemic, and this, of course, speaks to improper mismanagement leading into the pandemic, but that's a whole other story on itself. And this self-inflicted economic shutdown certainly didn't help things either. Now, the report says since 2017, the workforce has grown each year and supervisory FTE, or full-time equivalent positions, have grown disproportionately high compared to the non-supervisory full-time equivalent positions. Now, on a pure number-to-number basis, this means that there was a 22% increase to 589 middle managers, while the number of frontline supervisors has gone up by 19% to 1,242. With this, workforce costs have also increased $63 million since 2017, including $19 million spent on 232 new hires, which amounts to a 2% staff increase, but came with a cost increase of 5.6%. Now, the interesting part of this, though, is that non-supervisory positions ultimately dropped by 1%. So that's right. The number of middle managers and bosses in general in the city has been growing, but the number of actual workers decreased by 1%. Now, the current ratio across all city departments is 5 staff per 1 supervisor, and in the city's infrastructure department, the groups are even smaller, with a ratio of 2.3 staff per 1 supervisor. It's worth noting that these numbers do not take into account any layoffs as a result of the pandemic. Now, the mayor, after seeing this report, admitted that the city will need to, quote, shed some supervisory positions. He also said that he's going to need unusual cooperation, as he called it, from labor unions, because many of these supervisory positions are indeed union-based. This audit will be discussed by City Council on September 18th at a meeting, and there's, of course, a huge amount of irony in this that the council won't admit. The irony is that when the province mentioned reducing spending last year, it was the end of the world for the city administrations of Edmonton and Calgary. We need to be 100% clear on this, that the spending reductions asked for were not frontline workers at the city. The province suggested instead that the city look at management and reducing the overall spending costs by attrition and thinning the workforce. But now today, what the provincial government was saying last year was the problem is actually shown to be the problem by this audit. And this highlights the ideological divide between the reality of operating business, which the city can be seen as, and what the strong majority of city council members would like to focus on. That's why when the municipal elections come around next year, we should be ultimately paying special attention to who we're electing. And let's ask the question, are we electing a high school student council body focused on vanity projects, or are we going to look at this in the terms of electing a board for a corporation, the corporation being the city of Edmonton or Calgary?
Yes, and with the pandemic reducing a lot of job numbers in many businesses around the country, I think it is worth looking at our government positions and the public sector as an increase of government spending and waste that has been going on. The fact that staff positions had dropped and yet spending had still gone up regardless, it's certainly over the amount of the rate of inflation increase, and I think that there's definitely a lot of workforce waste that's been going on there, that a lot of these supervisor positions are not really doing as much supervising as they should be.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look into the corporate world outside of government, you will see that in many cases having a ratio of 2 employees or 2.5 employees for 1 supervisor, even 5, is much thinner than what we see in the private sector. And, you know, you just have to ask what has enabled that. And this report hopefully will be looked at with clear eyes by those on that committee who are going to be taking it up. Because the last thing you want is for the city council members to just disregard this report and then shift the blame of the spending cuts that need to be made to somewhere else, such as services like police or fire, for example, which of course will be a lightning rod in itself. And, you know, when it comes down to it, spending is something that every corporation and every type of city government has to take into account. And that's something we're even very cognizant of here at Western Context. And that's why if you want to help us with that, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context. And that's where you can support the podcast if you want. For $2 a month or the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll craft 2 Patreon-exclusive articles each month, expanding on our show stories from that month. And these stories will, of course, continue to provide the context and information that you've come to expect from us. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca /support. And with that being said, we're going to move over to Canada right now and pivot back to one of our episodes back in May when the Prime Minister issued his blanket gun ban.
Yes, in the beginning of May on episode 167, we discussed Justin Trudeau's gun ban, which was a reactionary policy released in the wake of the horrible and tragic spree shootings in Nova Scotia on April 19th. Now, in his legislation, Trudeau banned more than 1,500 guns or variants of guns that he described as being, quote, military-grade assault rifles. And assault weapons. Now, these were fancy names with no real definition that was meant to demonize the issue in the media by making these guns seem scary to the public and playing on fears that we've seen from the American media of armed populaces and increase of guns being used in crime. Now, at the time, Justin Trudeau told the country that he was doing it to tackle gun violence and to make Canada safer. He said at the time that, quote, every single Canadian wants to see less gun violence and safer communities, while calling the ban a big step forward. And on that, he was certainly right on the first part, where Canadians do want to see less gun violence and safer communities, but the ban is not really a big step forward as he was wanting it to be. His public safety minister, former Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair, at the time said enough is enough. Banning these firearms will save Canadian lives. And the fact that Trudeau had put Bill Blair on the front line of this issue is very head-scratching because Bill Blair, as we need to remember, was architect of the largest mass arrest in Canadian history at the 2010 G20 Toronto Summit protests. And these were marred by intense police brutality and human rights violations. And Bill Blair even lied about video evidence of police beating up an armed protester, saying that the evidence was tampered before retracting his statement, admitting that he actually had no evidence to support it. And the Toronto Police Service also held press conferences to speak out against inappropriate actions of the protesters, including displaying items alleged to have been seized from the protesters. However, when he was confronted, Bill Blair admitted that many of the items were completely unrelated to the protests altogether. And based on his horrific G20 response and his history of manipulation and lies, Bill Blair is the last person you want in charge of your government's response to curb violence. But instead, 10 years later, here we are. Now, Trudeau's sentiments of curbing gun violence and making safer communities would be admirable if he only focused government legislation on actually doing so, rather than tackle border security for illegal handguns imported from the United States through Toronto and Montreal, where the majority of shootings take place. He instead decided to go after one of his party's favorite scapegoats, which is legal gun owners. Now, many of the guns banned were designed to be used in Canada for hunting and aren't military grade. Since May 1st, hundreds more firearms have been added to the banned list, even though they are shotguns or bolt-action rifles. Now, in 2018, 249 out of 651 murders in Canada were committed with a firearm, and of those, about 60% of them were with handguns. As mentioned, this ban doesn't touch handguns, and it forgets that most of the illegal guns are smuggled in from the United States. Now, the ban is expansive and covers weapons such as the common Ruger Mini 14, often used by farmers to protect their livestock. And this weapon has multiple color and stock versions available, which can make it look like one of those scary military-style weapons. But the ban also includes some things that you would not expect to see on a gun ban, like the Mark 153 SMAW rocket launcher, the missile launcher FGM-148 Javelin, and the Russian artillery M1942 anti-tank gun. And you have to ask yourselves, when was the last time you saw someone robbing a store with a rocket launcher or doing a home invasion with an anti-tank gun? So how will this ban solve gun crime? After all, legal gun owners aren't the cause of gun crime in Canada. Up until Trudeau's gun ban, there were almost 100,000 AR-15 rifles legally owned in Canada. and the number of legally owned AR-15s that were proven to be used to kill anyone in Canada would shock many who just get their news from the media and the government, because that number is zero. And yet, it continues to be demonized by the government, who uses the menacing look of the gun to produce ineffectual legislation that doesn't accurately address the problem. Now, despite banning these scary assault weapons, handgun crime continues to rise, despite Trudeau's promise of safer communities. Now, between May 1st and September 6th, shootings were up in Toronto, as were the number of people killed by guns over the same period last year. Shootings are up 12.5% this summer compared to the same time period in 2019, and 24% higher than what was recorded during the summer of 2018. If you compare this to the summer of 2015, which was the summer just before Trudeau was elected, shootings have been up 83% over the last 5 years. Now, a parliamentary e-petition sponsored by Conservative Calgary MP Michelle Rempel-Garner that calls for the federal government to scrap its firearms ban has been certified with more than 230,000 signatures, which is the most on the online platform since it was introduced in 2015. The petition asks the Prime Minister to immediately scrap his, quote, firearms confiscation regime, calling it, quote, undemocratically imposed without debate during a pandemic while Parliament is suspended and an assault on Canadian democracy. Now, instead of a ban on assault-style weapons, Rempel-Garner's petition calls on the government to crack down on firearms obtained illegally, specifically targeting the prevention of smuggled firearms across the U.S. border. Rempel-Garner calls the issue truthfully with what is actually going on. Quote, Canada has one of the most rigorous firearms acquisition licensing regimes in the world. When we're looking at the very important issues of preventing firearms violence in Canada, we have to look at where firearms that are used in violent crime are coming from. And we know the vast majority of those are illegally obtained and primarily smuggled in from the United States. And as we saw with the Nova Scotia shootings back in April, most of the guns were actually used that were obtained illegally from the United States. And the last gun that was used was actually taken off of one of the deceased police officers that the gunman killed. So in the end, the gun ban would have not stopped that shooting, and instead it was just used to virtue signal that the Canadian government was actually doing something. Now, as Parliament is currently prorogued until September 23rd, Rempel-Garner will need to wait to table her petition. In the meantime, we know that this Liberal gun ban was never about keeping Canadians safer or reducing gun crime. This was about Trudeau looking like he was taking strong action when he wasn't. What Trudeau has banned were guns with no history of crime in this country, claiming that it would stop the shootings. And as we can see, the numbers show that that's not the case.
And this was a very politically expedient thing for the Prime Minister to do. And, you know, it was done in the same vein as, you know, gun bans that we've seen in New Zealand and the like. And, you know, if you ask many people about what exactly an AR-15 is, they would ultimately assume that the term AR refers to assault rifle, but it does not. It actually refers to the manufacturer of the gun, Arma Light Rifle. And, you know, this is a gun that's been demonized practically everywhere. And you know what the actual true story about this weapon is? It is just the gun that is chosen to be hit on by the media and the politicians who want to ban guns, because it looks like one of those military assault rifles which can fire hundreds of rounds a minute, but in, you know, most cases without severe modification, these guns are no different than some of the hunting rifles that you see out there. In fact, you can even have an AR-15 that looks like a standard hunting rifle in that case. But it doesn't ultimately change the fact that this is another case of the government and the media importing problems from the United States, attempting to solve them here when they don't exist, in the same way to push a political agenda. And that is a stance and an opinion, and quite honestly a fact at this point, that you will not hear anywhere else in the media. And quite honestly, to push a policy based on a fact like that, that is not true, is not good. And that's why this is on our show this week.
Yes, exactly. Just to see the numbers that, despite the gun ban happening, the numbers of violent crime, the numbers of shootings, the numbers of deaths from gun violence have still continued to grow. And despite Trudeau's gun ban to make things safer, we can see that this was just the government and the media, as you said, importing problems from the United States. And instead of actually looking at the issue, they should have been talking about what's actually happening, which is problems imported from the United States, which happens to be the violent handguns that are used through a lot of these violent shootings. And this is something that the government should have looked at. And it's quite clear that the Conservatives have the right idea on this matter, but the Liberals seem to be far off the mark once again.
That's right. And, you know, this is something that we've seen consistently from this government. And this also goes into our next story here, which is a new piece of legislation that is being promised by Heritage Minister Stephen Guilbeault. And you might recall that back in February, the Heritage Minister made a news appearance, and he went on CTV in particular and said that media publishing companies in Canada would have to be licensed in order to publish content. And the idea behind this, he said, was to protect Canadian content creators. This idea was quickly walked back, but this week we're seeing the alternate policy plan move forward on this, and it's being billed as reforms for web giants, as the government calls it. And this week, the minister again was giving an interview to CBC Radio Canada, where he said that large tech companies will have to produce Canadian content and support the media within this country if they don't want to be taxed. And with this, he is also going to be bringing in a sales tax for the internet giants, think Amazon in this case. Now, this also means that you're likely going to have to, of course, pay tax on your Apple TV Plus subscriptions, apps you buy on the Google or Apple App Store, your Netflix subscription, Spotify, and more, with this new internet sales tax that the government is going to bring in. Now, the government ultimately sees this as supporting Canadian content creators, but these actions, of course, go against the idea of a free and open market on the internet, which is how the internet was built and built these actual companies. Now, the way it's seen, according to the minister, is that it's not fair that a large company like Facebook, which is making record profits, being one of the largest companies in the world, that they don't adequately compensate Le Devoir or La Presse for the use of the content that they make on their platforms. Yeah, the minister actually said that Facebook should be compensating these newspapers here in Canada for the content that they put on their platforms. But, as with most things, this issue is far more nuanced than anyone in the government or the media is actually aware of. And with that, there are probably some people in the higher echelons of the media companies like Global and CTV who are aware of this but aren't able to push the issue appropriately. Now, the issue is that legacy media companies in Canada often see their headlines with excerpts posted on social media, whether that be Twitter or Facebook or Google News or Apple News and so on and so forth. And quite honestly, in the world of social media, a headline and a couple of sentences is often enough to get the gist of a story. We all know that. Everybody scrolls through their Facebook and Twitter and news timeline so quickly just to see news and really only dives into a story if it's truly interesting to them. There are other full news publishers out there like Facebook and Apple that publish the full story on their website or their news service and let the users read it is. Apple has Apple News Plus for any publication that wants to charge for access to articles. Big newspapers in the US like the Wall Street Journal do this. Facebook also has a service where news agencies can publish on Facebook and charge a fee for users to read it. Now, what the government wants effectively amounts to a link tax, like a hyperlink tax, which means that anytime there is a news story posted on one of these websites, they want the large company, Facebook, Google, practically anyone, to pay money to the company that owns that link. Now, the idea behind this is that some of the money that large tech companies earn will be funneled back to the media agencies in Canada, allowing them to produce that Canadian content. Now, every news company and even podcast here needs to be on social media to get discovered. It's just part of the game today with the way that news works online. competition in a market, whether it be your favorite supermarket chain, your favorite brand of shoes, or even these social media companies need to have competition to create a superior product, because if someone doesn't like your service that they receive at store A, they can go to store B and buy something else instead. But you have one choice for each type of online platform. There's one video service where you can be seen, and that's YouTube. There's one long-form social media service, that's Facebook. There's one short-form social media service, that's Twitter. And there's one place where the majority of Apple users can be expected to read their news, and that's Apple News. Now, the point of this is that we could go on and talk about each service, whether it be Spotify, Netflix, Google News, and so on and so forth. But the whole point is that the problem isn't on the size of the news media or the individual publishing platforms. News publishers have no choice but to be on these platforms to be seen. If you're Global News or CBC, your content is put onto the Facebook news aggregation feed for free. You could charge for it, but then you would, of course, be shooting yourself in the foot, because not every news company out there is going to charge people to see their articles. If the media doesn't like being there for free, or they feel it shortchanges their business model, they can ultimately opt out from being featured on the Facebook news feed or Apple News service. And what this means is that there just needs to be an alternate social media platform out there that caters to the demands of different kinds of publishers. Facebook is a monopoly and ultimately could fix this problem with their subscription news service if they wanted to, but the government will fix it for them, which also has the unfortunate side effect of enforcing the Facebook monopoly. Now, if you don't want your website to appear on Google or Google News, there's also simple changes to your website that can be made to make that happen as well. But because there exists only one type of all of these tech giants, you can't just not have a presence on each of these platforms that we've been talking about. The better solution, of course, would be to foster more competition on these platforms. Make it easier for there to be a Canadian Netflix streaming service, for example, or a Spotify-esque service run by the Chorus Radio Network if we're looking for Canadian-featured music and news programs. With this plan, the media will get some extra money from the tech giants, and there will be a Canadian section with Canadian content, and this is the problem that the government sees itself as fixing. But the problem it creates is that it makes it even harder for new tech startups to compete against these internet giants, because these internet giants just become more ingrained as the default option for many users. And what it also makes worse is the monopoly that those in the position of those such as YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook all enjoy. All in all, this is a solution by a government that doesn't understand what the actual problem here is.
Yes, and like many times we've seen, they're fixing a problem and creating a bunch of others in doing so. And it seems like they don't understand what the real issue is here. And the issue is that these big media companies are claiming that they're needing money from the big tech companies. And the tech companies have been largely operating without any oversight. And as soon as you start to put pressure on them, the tech companies will fight back, and this is something that we've seen in the U.S. quite a bit, but certainly hasn't been seen as much in Canada, because the Canadian government seemed to be very content to let them have free rein. But now they're trying to push the issue on something that isn't actually going to benefit that many Canadians, and instead is going to benefit the media companies in Canada, of which we already have a high concentration of in a very small number of people. And I think that's something that is missed in this story as well, is that a lot of the smaller media companies are still owned by bigger companies themselves. And I think that really it's just the government pushing legislation to help other corporations and to stop new ones from starting up. And I think that when you look at it from that point of view, as you said, making the monopoly position more entrenched in the eyes of the public is something that is taking one step forward, four steps back. And it's not the first time we've seen it with this government, and certainly won't be the last.
Yeah, and you know, you add one big competitor to each of these platforms. You add a video competitor, you add a competitor to Facebook. This problem will effectively go away, because the media publishers, or the media companies rather, will be able to go talk to different publishers and get a better rate. And that's the whole idea of competition. And this will make the whole idea of a link tax and giving money back to the media companies something that doesn't need to happen. Or we could just be in the position right now where the media companies have also successfully lobbied the government and asked for more money, and this is just their way of doing it. So nonetheless, there are – this is a multifaceted issue, and the government isn't pushing the right buttons on this. And it's rather unfortunate because, as we all know, everybody would love there to be a good competitor to YouTube, to Twitter, to Facebook, but unfortunately that doesn't exist. And that's something that the government could use their fingerprints for or their hand for to be a force for good. And, you know, we see this each and every week. The government tries to do something, tries to be a force for good, but in many ways it backfires. And this takes us into our firing line story right now, because this is something that is extremely hypocritical from this government and quite honestly borders on the issues of racism.
Yes, exactly. And this was the story that came out this past week, that we have seen vastly different economic policies between the leaders of the Conservative and the Liberal parties, revealing both leaders' visions for Canada as we head closer towards a possible fall election. Now, new Conservative leader Erin O'Toole says that his plan for a Canada First economic strategy would prioritize the needs of working families and take a harder line against China in international affairs. Now, immediately as O'Toole uttered the words Canada First, the media was very quick to make comparisons between him and Donald Trump, as the media and the Liberal Party would much rather continue campaigning against Trump than to actually look at Conservative parties as leaders in their own right with their own ideas and policies. Now, O'Toole, for his part, described his policy as actually delving more into self-sufficiency than Trump's, especially with food and energy security, as well as in-country production of personal protective equipment to combat the pandemic, which is similar to strategies adopted by the Ontario and Quebec governments since March. Now, O'Toole also said that his approach wouldn't stray as far into protectionism as Trump's has. He said, quote, I'm more of a free trader than what we see in the United States right now. We see some protectionism, and we really see a couple of large corporate interests being advanced. That actually hurts a lot of middle-sized employers in both the United States and Canada, which is interesting because that calls back to the previous story where we're seeing the large corporate tech interests being advanced over what the middle-sized employers are actually doing. Now, O'Toole also committed during the interview to meeting Canada's greenhouse gas emission targets under the Paris Agreement, which he pointed out were set by the previous Conservative government led by Stephen Harper. And to get there, though, O'Toole said that he would let the provinces take the lead rather than force policy from the federal government like Trudeau's carbon tax has. O'Toole also used his first speech to his party's caucus on Wednesday to declare that they will be an intelligent, compassionate alternative to Justin Trudeau's Liberals. And he argued that Trudeau created deep problems in Canada even before the pandemic hit, and pledged that the Conservatives will show that they are ready now to govern the country. Now, the speech began with the message of unity for the Conservatives and then slammed Trudeau's record of managing the economy, and ended with a lengthy discussion of Louis Riel, John A. Macdonald, and how Canada's past must not be cancelled, but instead used to inform debates about the future. O'Toole's speech argued that Trudeau had stoked divisions in Canada well before the COVID-19 crisis, citing office towers standing empty in Calgary and the rail blockades that had dominated the news in January and February. As O'Toole said, quote, it would have been difficult enough to guide our country through this pandemic and rebuild if we had entered the crisis united and with a strong economy. Instead, we entered the pandemic divided, disrespected, and indebted. Now, we've already talked about the gun ban earlier on the show, which was designed to throw the crosshairs on legal gun owners instead of criminals. A day after O'Toole's speech about uniting the country, Trudeau introduced more legislation intended to divide Canadians against each other, which just proved the Conservative leader right. Now, Justin Trudeau on Wednesday revealed a new $221 million federal program that will give loans and support for training and mentorship for Black Canadian entrepreneurs. Another $6.5 million will go to collect data on the state of black entrepreneurship and identify the barriers preventing black Canadians from succeeding in business. Trudeau said that the COVID-19 pandemic has put a spotlight on the systemic gaps and economic barriers that black Canadians face every day, and that his government wants a pandemic recovery that is, quote, inclusive and equitable for all Canadians. In response to the July Black Lives Matter protests that swept across North America, Trudeau announced his cabinet had created a summer work plan to draft policies to tackle systemic racism in Canada and to help eliminate barriers facing Indigenous and racialized people and those with disabilities. Now, while support for black Canadians to get ahead in business is admirable, it's odd that just black people will be benefiting from this program, given that they aren't the only minorities or people in Canada in need of a step up. First Nations have faced discrimination and systemic racism for years, yet this program deliberately excludes them as well as all others. It's a head-scratcher to focus help on a person just based on the color of their skin, rather than looking at opportunities to help all Canadians who need the opportunity, whether black, First Nations, Asian, or white. Now, the government's official press release calls the program progress in advancing equitable access to support and opportunities, while forgetting that equitable and equal are not the same thing. Not only that, but Trudeau's new program may even fly in the face of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms that his father passed to guarantee equal rights for all Canadians. Section 15 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms contains guaranteed equality rights, which is not the same as equitable rights, as Trudeau was talking about. Now, as part of the Constitution of Canada, the section prohibits certain forms of discrimination perpetrated by the governments of Canada, with the exception of ameliorative programs, example being employment equity. It says in total, quote, every individual is equal before and under the law and has the right to the equal protection and equal benefit of the law without discrimination, and in particular without discrimination based on race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental or physical disability. Subsection 1 does not preclude any law, program, or activity that has as its object the amelioration or of conditions of disadvantaged individuals or groups, including those that are disadvantaged because of race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental or physical disability. So while not against the letter of the Constitution, Trudeau certainly skirts around the edges, as he so often does, and the fact that his policy of reverse racism is endorsed by his father's ambiguous document is a constitutional nightmare. In this, it can be seen that disadvantaged people can be whoever the government and courts want them to be, to the exclusion of all else. In this particular case, it's black Canadians. Now, instead of focusing on one group, why not attempt to uplift all disadvantaged Canadians equally, rather than zoning in on particular groups at a time when it's politically expedient to do so? Because, after all, it could be said that this program is going against disadvantaged individuals just by deliberately excluding them. Now, at this time, during one of the toughest peacetime years in history, we see one party that looks to put all Canadians first against bigger countries looking to bully us and to go against Canadian economic progress, while the other party looks to focus help for only select groups of Canadians. In the fall, we might find that we'll have a choice of which vision we believe is best.
And when you look at so many of these things that have come up, from this to the discussion about the internet giants, none of these were in the federal platform last year, and Canadians didn't vote for it. And the very fact that we're talking about a policy that effectively amounts to reverse racism could pose interesting questions for the Supreme Court. Because if you look back at what the Supreme Court has ruled, they have ruled in the past against, or rather for, in favor of disadvantaged Canadians. And if the government is putting out a policy today that effectively denies programs and benefits to those in the past that the Supreme Court had said were disadvantaged, we could be looking at a situation here where this program is deemed unconstitutional if it were to go to the Supreme Court. And that's just how much of a mess this thing is going to turn out to be. Because, you know, not many people are talking about this. This wasn't mentioned at all in the media this week. Yes, it was mentioned that, you know, Trudeau is bringing out a new spending program that is going to help the Black community. Yes, that was mentioned. But the amount of analysis and thoughtful work that went into this was sorely lacking. Because if you look into this program and if you look into what exactly it's saying, it's reverse racism. And this is being endorsed by a prime minister and a government, a prime minister that should have been shown the door in the middle of the last election campaign for the numerous blackface escapades that surfaced during that campaign. And he wasn't, and used it as a teaching tutorial for all Canadians. Really underscores where we're at here when it comes to what the media is looking at. Because, you know, you have to ask yourself, in what world does the leader of a G7 country get to commit blackface 15, 20 years ago, maybe more since then, come out during the middle of an election campaign with those revelations, say sorry, use it as a teaching method, and we all move happily along. And then we here got a policy that is effectively bringing in reverse racism. But nobody is, of course, linking the dots to how this could be unconstitutional or the very fact that we had those blackface episodes during the last campaign. It's quite honestly absurd.
Yeah, it seems weird that this story in total only received a few paragraphs in each media outlet across the country. And this was a very big story. This is a huge multi-million dollar program that is going towards helping Black Canadians succeed in business. And while helping Black Canadians succeed in business is a good thing to do, the very fact that they're in doing so, they're excluding other disadvantaged Canadians from being able to access the program, it makes you scratch your head, because at this point, you have to think to yourself, how are you going to prove that you are worthy enough of the program? Are they going to have a look? Are they going to have to look at you to see if you're Black enough? Or are they going to have to look to make sure that you have the ancestry there? Are they going to have to look to see if you identify as such? It's going to be a mess, and it doesn't make much sense to do. And it seems like it's going to be much more problems than it's worth. What they should have done is done a program that would be able to help people based on income rather than based on their personal characteristics. And I think that's something, and again, it's another issue, third time this week, that we've seen where the government is trying to do something to help Canadians but is completely missing the mark and is doing something that may actually hurt Canadians in the future.
And what it comes down to at the end of the day is a very simple way of looking at this for all those stories that you just mentioned there. And it's a government sowing division, because it's an easy thing to campaign on when your opponent is actually starting to look pretty good. And that takes us nicely into our word of the week.
Yes, and our word of the week this week is division, which is described in many different ways, but mostly as a partition that divides two groups or things. It could also be described as a disagreement between two or more groups, typically producing tension or hostility. And I think that's what we've seen this week, is a government that's been trying to produce division, and that it's trying to pit different groups of Canadians against others, and it's trying to make it so that we can't all unite under a common goal. And I think that's something that this government has been very successful at over the past 5 years, at trying to portray themselves as working for all Canadians, but not really doing as such. And I think we've seen that more and more often this week, and especially over the past few months since the pandemic started. And I think the politics of division that we've seen from this government have been completely missed by the media. And that's why this is our word of the week this week.
It's a pretty good word. And, you know, I imagine we'll be hearing a lot more about that, especially as we ramp up to the throne speech in just a couple weeks. But that's pretty much it for this episode of Western Context. If you want full show notes, you can find those at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, practically anything else, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, you name it, at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share our shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always be sure to look through all the stories in the media that the media doesn't want to highlight or put out there, just so that you can have the full context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.